Good morning. My talk this morning is entitled Inconceivable Perfection. Try as we might, it's hard to avoid. It sounds like a Lutheran sermon to me. I didn't quite like it, but that's what I came up with. I am going to talk about inconceivable perfection. That is the topic. And I'm going to tell a couple of stories about inconceivable perfection from several different angles. I'm going to try to relate it all to Zazen, our meditation practice. I came up with the topic, it came to me a couple different ways. One was I was reading the newspaper a few weeks ago, and there was a picture of some animals and plants that were recently discovered in the bottom of the ocean, anywhere from about a mile to 5 miles down in the ocean. These are species that had never been discovered before. And some of them were discovered in areas in the ocean bottom where scientists had thought it was simply miles and miles and miles and miles of desert, underwater desert. These are strange beings. I have a picture of them. I'm going to pass it around. One of them is called the deep sea siphonophrone, and another one is called a colophrene Jordani fanfin sea devil. And I thought to myself, here are these, and some of them are tiny. I mean, they're very thin. I mean, they look like jellyfish. One of them, two of them, look like jellyfish. 5 miles below the surface of the ocean, and I'm thinking, what is the pressure? What is the water pressure 5 miles below the surface of the ocean? How did these things live? How did this come to be? And so that stimulated part of my impetus for this talk. These are the fish, and I will pass this around. Some of them are a little strange, but the other impetus for the talk was sitting at Hokyoji, which is a retreat down in the southeast part of the state, Zen retreat, and watching swallows during a retreat, during the mornings. And so on the other side, I've copied out a page of Sibley's Birds of America, and it has swallow, specifically the barn swallow on the back of that. So as I'm talking, you can, for those of you who like visual things, there you go. That's all you get. So the swallows. This summer we had a week-long retreat at Hokyoji, and it's, in the mornings I would sit and drink my coffee after breakfast, and there's a field where the grass was mown, and then beyond that was a field where the grass wasn't mown, and then of course, the term mowed. I guess it's mowed. And then there are trees. Kind of, there are hills and woods about those two fields. And I would watch these swallows fly incessantly, fly back and forth. And some of you who you've seen swallows, some of you may not know it, but they kind of dart, and they dart and they swoop, and they're very, very graceful. And the barn swallow, particularly, is an elegant bird. It makes wonderful twists and turns and dodges as it seeks out its morning meals. And I found myself wondering, well, okay, here we are. It's June. Am I looking at a swallow that has, in the last 3 or 4 months, flown up from Brazil? And these things weigh about, you know, like about 2/3 of an ounce. Is the swallow, is that living being I'm looking at right now, is that one being that has flown from Brazil in the last 4 months to southeast Minnesota, paired with another swallow, spent about 2 weeks building a nest, laying eggs, raising a brood of maybe five or six young swallows, and is now out, probably vacationing after all that work. But is that the bird I'm looking at? Or am I looking at the bird, a bird? Because you can't tell juveniles from adults very well in barn swallows. Am I looking at a bird that is maybe 3 weeks old and doesn't yet know Brazil, but will? And I was just kind of dumbfounded by that. What am I looking at? These birds swooping back and forth, picking off mosquitoes and other bugs. And then I noticed that there were other birds on the ground, cowbirds and robins. And there were other birds in the trees, cedar waxwings and goldfinches, and other birds still in the high grass, sparrows. And then I'd hear a woodpecker in the woods, and I began to ponder on the mystery of all that. Each of these birds basically has its own little niche. The birds that are on the flat grass won't go into the tall grass. The birds that are eating bugs in the air are not eating bugs off the trees. And they've all got this dance that's going on right in front of my eyes. And it's been developing for millennia. And it's unfolding right there. And usually, you know, I just, you know, there's a bird. But I was in a state of mind where I was taking that all in morning after morning. And then, of course, my mind turned to what I wasn't seeing. The probably several thousand species of insects in the trees and grasses and the invertebrates and the mammals and the animals in the soil. All kind of unfolding there. And that's where inconceivable came to my mind. What I'm looking at right now is inconceivable. I can try to get my mind around it, but I really can't get my mind around it. And then there's a container that this is all unfolding in. As I sit there, I'm watching, observing the scene, but I'm a part of this scene. I mean, there's the air, there's the soil, there's the water that's circulating, there's the sunlight that's coming down and making food, energy out of chlorophyll that we're all eating. Me, the birds, we're all kind of part of that cycle, and it's all unfolding on this little thin crust on a molten-bellied planet, and it's all just happening, and it's all entirely interconnected. I mean, the air, it dawned on me, I am not separate, one iota, from what I was observing. I can't be. I mean, that it's the same air, it's the same water, it's the same energy circulating, and for millennia, I've been on my trip with this whole menagerie that I was watching, and it's developed over, it's co-developed, it's co-evolved over millions and millions of years. And then I thought about my heart, and my blood system, and my lungs. That bird has a heart, lungs, blood system. How did that happen? We're different species. How do I have a heart and it has a heart? Now, of course, its heart is different than mine. It has eyes. It has senses. And I got in the Buddhist realm, senses. It's got the same senses I do. You might argue about consciousness, but I'm not going to go there. You could think about the five skandhas, which is a Buddhist way of thinking about heaps of matter, heaps of energy, heaps of something that come together to form a being. And, well, that swallow has skandhas. That swallow could be conceived of as just a heap of form, feelings, sensations. I mean, there was nothing we didn't have in common, that swallow and me. There really was nothing we didn't have in common. I was struck by the dependent or co-arising that is a Buddhist principle, that everything is arising in this moment and is totally interconnected. And I had a sense of that. Morning after morning, I would be sitting with my coffee watching this unfold. And those birds were only out there for about 2 hours every morning. And I'd come back in the evening right about the same time. And I'm sure that had something to do with where the bugs were. And that had something to do with where the sun was. And that had something to do with where the hill was. And on and on and on. You get the picture. I mean, my mind could go on and on and on with that. And it did. It did. John Muir said, when you tug on a single thing in nature, you find it is attached to the entire universe. My partner is reading Darwin's Origin of the Species. And what I'm talking about is relatively new thinking for human beings. This concept of evolution, the concept of interdependence. We Westerners have come about this only recently, quite frankly. Only in the last century and a half. But those Buddhists, they've been on this for a long time. I'm going to read a little section from Mountains and Waters Sutra, which is written by Eihei Dogen, who is the Japanese 13th century monk. And the Mountains and Waters Sutra is, he wrote quite a bit, but this is the only thing he referred to as a sutra. And in fact, it's one of the few things that is referred to as a sutra that has not been, that is not the words, supposedly, of the Buddha. It's a little different take on that inconceivable perfection that I was observing with my Western mind at Hokyoji. There are mountains hidden in treasures. There are mountains hidden in swamps. There are mountains hidden in the sky. There are mountains hidden in mountains. There are mountains hidden in hiddenness. This is complete understanding. An ancient Buddha said, mountains are mountains, waters are waters. These words do not mean mountains are mountains. They mean mountains are mountains. Therefore, investigate mountains thoroughly. When you investigate mountains thoroughly, this is the work of mountains. Such mountains and waters of themselves become wise persons and sages. It is not only that there is water in the world, but there is a world in water. It is not just in water. There is also a world of sentient beings in clouds. There is a world of sentient beings in the air. There is a world of sentient beings in fire. There is a world of sentient beings on earth. There is a world of sentient beings in the phenomenal world. There is a world of sentient beings in a blade of grass. There is a world of sentient beings in one staff. Wherever there is a world of sentient beings, there is a world of Buddha ancestors. You should thoroughly examine the meaning of this. At the hour of the rat, 18th day, 10th month, first year of the Ninji, 1240. In my mind, that's kind of a similar take, but there is a difference, and I'm going to throw a question out here. Does anybody sense, so I did this riff on the swallows and ecological niches and evolution. And this is a different riff, but they are different. And I'm going to. Does anybody have an impression of what's different here? Those two perspectives. I was right there with the swallow. And he's right, yeah. Anything else? Any other? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think Dogen was looking at the, like, she said that it was the big picture, and you were doing a lot of deconstruction, mm-hmm. getting down to the earth and the soil, the heart.
Yeah.
And finding the Buddha in there.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? I think that's all true. What I was struck by a little bit is... Dogen is anything but rational here. I mean, he's asking you to suspend your logical thinking. I mean that's in some ways the purpose of an ancient Buddha said, mountains are mountains, waters are waters. These words do not mean mountains are mountains. They mean mountains are mountains. He's really attempting, I think, to just, you know, with words, kind of get rid of words. Get us beyond the logic of it, because it is inconceivable. Because it is inconceivable. I think it's the difference between Western mind and Eastern mind to some extent. I think it's what I described with the swallows is kind of, if you will, a Western, it's deconstructive, and it's a Western perspective on the same whatever. But Westerners kind of go at it from a picking apart and getting all the pieces in place. I'm going to read a short quote here from a book on lichens. But it struck me. The urge to organize diverse things into groups is one of the most basic of human traits. Creating order out of apparent chaos is a deeply satisfying endeavor, whether it is organizing food in a kitchen, items in a newspaper, or species in the living world. And I think that's true. You know, I think that's in some ways... I was going to say, in some ways, that's what causes suffering. But I'm going to pull that one back, I think. I'm not sure about that. But we all know that. It is a very human trait to want to organize, to want to have our world organized. And there's something about that that has to do with our ego. Post-enlightenment in particular, Western Enlightenment in particular, that's been a strong trait of our thinking. But I do think both of these are getting at the same thing. I'd like to read another quote, which is taking it's another take on what I'm calling inconceivable perfection. And this is from the Avatamsaka Sutra. So now we're going. So we're going from Western thinking to Japanese Buddhist thinking to Indian Buddhist thinking. And I want to. The Avatamsaka Sutra is pretty important to Zen, even though it's Indian. And I'll just, to give you a sense of it, because this is a lead-in to what you're going to hear. The Avatamsaka Sutra is not only the most grandiose visionary work in the history of Mahayana Buddhism, but certainly one of the most imaginative and inspired masterworks of religious literature anywhere. That's pretty hefty praise. I'm trying to make the case here that this is going to be strikingly different, is the same thing as the last two things I've talked about. This is from a chapter in the Avatamsaka Sutra called The Dwelling Places of Enlightening Beings. It's only a page and a half, but I'm only going to read part of it because you'll get the drift fairly quickly. Then the great enlightening being, Mind King, said to the enlightening being. So here we got Mind King, who is a great enlightening being. A great enlightening being is a bodhisattva, a great, wise being in the world who has chosen not to enter nirvana and become a Buddha, but to stay in the world and free all sentient beings. So these are great enlightening bodhisattvas. So this is Mind King, a great enlightening being, talking to a bunch of great enlightening beings. So it's a convention of bodhisattvas. The great enlightening being, Mind King, said to the enlightening beings, "In the east there is a place called Wizard Mountain, where enlightening beings have lived since ancient times. At present there is an enlightening being named Best of Diamonds there, with a group of followers, 300 enlightening beings, always there expounding the teaching. In the south, there is a place called Outstanding Peak, where enlightening beings have dwelled since ancient times. Now there is an enlightening being named Spiritual Wisdom there, with a group of followers, 500 enlightening beings, always there expounding the teaching. In the west, there is a place called Diamond Flame Mountain, where enlightening beings have lived since ancient times. Now there is an enlightening being named Vigorous Fearless Action there, with a following of 300 enlightening beings, always expounding the teaching. In the north, there is a place called Mass of Fragrance Mountain, where enlightening beings have lived since ancient times. Now there is an enlightening being named Musky Elephant there, with a following of 300 enlightening beings, always expounding the teaching. In the northeast, there is a place called Clear Cool Mountain, where enlightening beings have lived since ancient times. Now there is an enlightening being there named Manjushri, with a following of 10,000 enlightening beings, always expounding the teaching. In the ocean, there is a place called Diamond and on. I think that's just another culture describing inconceivable perfection. I think it's in many ways the same thing as Dogen was writing about, and it's the same thing I was talking about, but with entirely different language. Everywhere, in all time, enlightening beings are, and perfection is unfolding. It is. It's just everywhere, all the time. And I have a harder time relating to this language because I think it's a little bit more foreign to me. But I think it's the same message, that is inconceivable perfection is everywhere at all times. One more take on it. This idea of inconceivable perfection. This one is from Gary Snyder, who is a living poet and a Zen practitioner. And interestingly, this is a commentary he wrote called... I think it's called Blue Mountains Constantly Walking. And it's a commentary on Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra. Dogen is not concerned in Mountains and Water Sutra with sacred mountains or pilgrimages or spirit allies or wilderness as some quality. His mountains and streams are the processes of this earth, all of existence, process, essence, action, absence. They roll being and non-being together. They are what we are what they are. For those who would see directly into essential nature, the idea of the sacred is a delusion and an obstruction. It diverts us from seeing what is before our eyes, plain thusness. Roots, stems, and branches are all equally scratchy, no hierarchy, no equality, no occult and exoteric, no gifted kids and slow achievers, no wild and tame, no bound or free, no natural and artificial, each totally its own frail self, even though connected all which ways, even because connected all which ways. This thusness is the nature of nature, the wild and the wild. So, blue mountains walk to the kitchen and back to the shop, to the desk, to the stove. We sit on the park bench and let the wind and rain drench us. Blue mountains walk out to put another coin in the parking meter and go on down to the 7-Eleven. The blue mountains march out of the sea, shoulder the sky for a while, and slip back into the waters. So I think Snyder here is, is connecting it all, connecting the rising and falling of mountains with walking to the 7-Eleven. It's all part of the same unfolding. Those mountains rose and fell to the sea in the lifespan of human beings. I mean, our species has risen, and actually, if you look at the evolution of our species, you know, our ancestors have risen and fallen over periods of millions of years, as have mountains. And we have been formed by the mountains. And in fact, the mountains have been formed by us. We're inseparate. And we're inseparate, and that's all inseparable from the parking meter and the nickel you put in it. Now it's a quarter you put in. And it's all, we use words, I use words, Dogen uses words, the Mind King uses words, but there are no words really. There are no words really that can get at it, that can really describe it. And I'm saying inconceivable perfection, and what I'm talking about really is emptiness, is thusness. I'm just using the term inconceivable perfection. It's probably not perfect, but it is inconceivable. So those are takes on this unfolding that's right before us right now, that's happening right this moment. And I want to relate it to our practice. I want to relate it to Zazen, to meditation. Dogen says, the Zazen I speak of is not meditation practice or learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease. The Dharma gate of joy and repose. So we sit and we meditate. There is no way that in that moment we are not manifesting inconceivable perfection. We are it. There's no way to get away from it. As we're sitting on the cushion or we're walking to put a coin in the meter, we are manifesting inconceivable perfection as much as that swallow or that cicada or the mountain right now that is rising and falling. We are it. Now, we maybe don't realize it, and we maybe think about a lot of stuff and a lot of emotions come up, but they add no value and they take nothing away. We are manifesting thusness. We are manifesting inconceivable perfection as we sit on the cushion. And there's no getting away from it. There's no place to go. There's nothing to do as we sit on the cushion. And yet it's so hard. We can't avoid it, but it's so hard to realize it. It's so hard to realize and just settle into the fact that just by sitting on the cushion, we are, if you will, in nirvana. Nirvana is not somewhere else. Inconceivable perfection is not somewhere else. Emptiness is not somewhere else. It's right there when you're sitting on the cushion. It's right there as you're sitting on your chair right now. It's right here. There's really nothing to do. There's no place to go. It's kind of useless striving for whatever it is we are striving for as we sit on the cushion. So the blue mountains walk to the kitchen and back to the shop, to the desk, to the stove. We sit on the park bench and let the wind and rain drench us. The blue mountains walk out to put another coin in the parking meter and go down to the 7-Eleven. The blue mountains march out of the sea, shoulder the sky for a while, and slip back into the waters. I'm done, I think. And it all started with that ugly little fish that I saw in the newspaper and wondering how in the world did that ever come about. Anybody have any comments or questions or thoughts, opinions, reactions? Yes. Very good question. Very good question. She said, if everything is perfection, why have a Zen center? Why sit? Why meditate? It's a good question. And, I don't know that there's any true answer in Dogen's Fukaza Zengi, which is his universal recommendations on meditation, and there's probably copies of it in this room, he asked the same question in the first paragraph. He mentions all the ways, actually four ways, in which everything is right here now, everything's perfect right now. What is the use of practice? And then he says, and yet, if there is a hair's breadth deviation, it is like the gap between heaven and earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. And then he goes on and talks about the Buddha sitting for 6 years and Bodhidharma sitting for facing a wall for 10 years, meditating. And he says, and if the ancient sages were like this, how is it now that we could If even the ancient sages were like this, how can we today dispense of wholehearted practice? So, why practice? If everything's perfect, why do we suffer? Because that's what it's about. I mean, in essence, the Buddha's teaching is about suffering, that it is part of the human condition, and there is a way to relieve suffering. And the question might be, well, if everything's perfect, how can we suffer? But we do. And if we desire to bring an end to confusion and suffering in ourselves and others, I guess that's the reason to practice. And the paradox there is that that suffering is also perfection. It's also what is. It's also, I mean, it exists. It's part of the mix. Yes?
In Gary Snyder, a line in there about the sacred in devotion, can you read that again?
That's my favorite line. I certainly would be glad to. One of my favorite lines is not my favorite. I actually wasn't going to read that section, but I did. Dogen is not concerned with sacred mountains or pilgrimages or spirit allies or wilderness as some special quality. For those who would see directly into essential nature, the idea of the sacred is a delusion and an obstruction. It diverts us from seeing what is before our eyes, plain thusness. Snyder is talking about thusness. My Western ecological take, I think, was about emptiness in some ways. And Dogen was about emptiness, the piece that I read. And I think probably the piece that I read from the Avatamsaka Sutra was talking about Buddha nature. And I'm lumping all of those kind of together and calling it inconceivable perfection. And I don't like, but to answer your question a little bit further, I don't like the term perfection. I think it's a bad word. It doesn't fit. Any other comments or yes?
It seems to me that a lot of what Dogen says and Koan's descriptions that you've read today, there's a disconnect in the way in with the storyline. A lot of it, in my mind, is that Dogen and Gary Snyder and others are asking us to suspend our rational mind in order to see, to delve into suchness and emptiness. And mm-hmm. I can use my, as soon as you create a rational thought, you're creating the object subject continuum. And it works when you're thinking about crossing the street, whether it's at the right time to cross the street if the car's coming up. And you can answer questions like that when you're trying to answer questions like, why did 9/11 happen? Why did this person die? Or why did I lose my job? Your rational mind still engages, but there's no answer. Mm-hmm. And the answer is beyond. And I think Dogen and Collins and Gary Snyder are suggesting you have to suspend your rational mind to essentials, because so much of what exists in the universe is beyond whether an individual swallow is existing in itself, east of Minnesota, and whether it goes down to Brazil, but the flow that is happening before you and how inconceivable that is when you create a continuum between object and subject.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true.
I like inconceivable. And at the risk of being ironic, as I try to order this into a system, it seems like so much of what you're saying, what I deal with my wife, what I deal with on an everyday basis is, oh, I don't know that. Let's go deeper. Versus, I know that. Let's stop and fight about it. Mm. It seems to be, again, at the risk of being putting it into an order, it seems to be where we have major differences in this country in terms of people thinking that they have the concept of what perfection is. Mm-hmm. Let's stop it and fight about it versus, yes, let's just go deep. Mm-hmm. Let's, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That resonates with me. And that unless we can figure out a way to let go and all of us kind of go deeper, then I mean, that's where we get stuck.
You had been talking about organization and needing to organize and thinking about it's imperative in some way to be able to organize things so that if we create some kind of organization or structure, we can like go beyond it. So like if we have some kind of, you know, the idea of form is empty, that if we have some structure of a schedule, let's say, it's like we know what the schedule is and then we don't have to worry about it, you know. And so there's good reasons on one hand for some organization to create the space to get there.
Well, I think that's true. And if you look at Dogen's monastery, talk about order, you know. Incredible order. And there's nothing wrong with there really is nothing wrong with rational thinking. There's nothing wrong with a scientific way. There's nothing wrong with creating order. We need that. What the encouragement is to recognize that's all on the surface, and that even as we have the order, even as we think about important scientific stuff, advances, or whatever, to not lose sight of the fact that we are manifesting at that moment this inconceivable perfection. We're part of it. Yes.
Why did you say that you were satisfied with the word perfection, inconceivable? Okay. Why are you not satisfied with perfection?
Well, the term is used a lot in Buddhism. I don't know. Is the term inconceivable perfection used? Does anybody know? In kind of Buddhist literature, the term inconceivable is used a lot, and the term perfection is used a lot. I don't know that. And perfection is the reason I don't. Why wasn't it quite the right word?
It implies an absence of perfection.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Yeah.
There's a judging self.
Yeah.
There's a
division. Yeah.
But as long as I can see inconceivable perfection in quote unquote imperfection, then I'm not locking myself in imperfection.
Right.
It's like Tim's little article I was just reading this morning about returning to zero. Returning to zero means room for belief and disbelief. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exclude you.
I have trouble with the word perfection too, and it might be a translation issue. I know even in the Bible there's a line that says, "Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." And I've read commentaries where a better translation of that would be wholeness or complete. Be complete and be whole. And maybe that would be an inconceivable wholeness or completeness.
And again, we're trying to use words, but I like that. And the reason I used it was because I think it's important as we're sitting to have that sense, and wholeness might be just as good a word, that there's nothing going on that we need to get away from or nothing. I mean, it's all right here, right now. It's all, and that's the reason I used it.